Welcome to the Social Justice Salon. I am your hostess, Marianne Moore, a social justice advisor and political philosopher passionate about recreating our world. In this podcast, we will evoke the grand revolutionary salons of the past by engaging with thinkers and practitioners about social justice issues, showcasing grassroots activism, diving into theory and grounding ourselves with everyday methods to effect real-life change in society. Join us and we will furnish you with the knowledge and clarity you need to understand and improve our world. Let's enter the salon. Hello and welcome to episode 17 of the now rebranded Social Justice Salon. And I am really excited about the episode that we have for you today because we have a titan of the finance and economic world talking to us all about everything to do with finance, extractive finance, predatory finance, and monopolies. This is Nicholas Shackson. Now, Nicholas Shackson writes the kind of books that people clutch while they are protesting. He is that cool. So I'm sure most of you do know who he is, but in case you don't, I'm just going to say a little bit about him. He is a journalist, author, and activist focusing on finance and economics and their relationships to people and societies. He's written for numerous publications, including the Financial Times, The Guardian, The Economist, and The New York Times, and has written a number of fantastic books. Poisoned Wells, in 2007, about oil, politics, and conflict in West Africa. Treasure Islands, in 2011, about tax havens. And The Finance Curse, in 2018, about the domestic impacts of oversized financial sectors, particularly the UK and Ireland. He was a foundational member of the Global Tax Justice Movement and in 2021 co-founded the Balanced Economy Project, the first general international anti-monopoly NGO of the modern age. He's currently writing a new book on monopoly power, which is what we're going to focus on when we speak to him today. He has so much wisdom to share that we just need to dive into the episode because he says so much. So without further ado, let's just get started and find out what he has to tell us. Hello, Nick. It's so amazing to have you on the podcast. You're based in Berlin, and as I understand, your son is currently whistling.
Yes, I'm a little concerned because he was whistling quite noisily. So I, if necessary, I'll go out and chide him, but he's all right.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. I am a major fan of yours, having read two of your books, Treasure Islands and The Finance Curse. And it's just really exciting to be able to have you here and to be able to understand way more from you in person and to get a real sense of some of the pertinent issues that you're currently writing about. But it would be great, because you've just done so much, if you could start by just saying a little bit about who you are for our listeners so they know more about you.
Okay. So I mean, I'm basically a journalist and a writer by background. I've written for lots of different organizations and I've written three books and I'm writing a fourth now. So my field has always been kind of related to money, finance, and there were sort of links with society and people and kind of the human world. And I've always been activist in that sense, and I've always had opinions. I mean, some journalists are like, you know, try and be neutral on everything, whatever that means. But I always like, I always find sort of, you know, bad guys out there in the world and say this is bad, and that's kind of who I am. I've also been involved in the NGO world. I was from the very early years of the Tax Justice Network. I was in and Tax Justice Movement. I was heavily involved in that at the same time as doing journalism. And more recently, in 2021, I co-founded a little anti-monopoly organization called the Balanced Economy Project, which I left last year. And so I'm kind of, yeah, I'm sort of like an activist journalist with an interest in sort of finance, economics, and power, and how that relates to society and people.
Fantastic. And it's so good to be able to have you to talk to about this, because I think the topics that you're dealing with in terms of finance and economics, to some people, they can seem really complex and bamboozling. There's lots of different terminology. And for people who may not be so familiar with some of these terms, it's going to be really useful for you to help break this stuff down and help people to understand more about it. But it'd be great if I could just understand first, what got you into this? What was the motivating factor that led you into these topics?
So just on one of the things you said it's complicated and difficult for people to access. I think that's it's a very important point before I get into sort of my story, because with the tax justice movement, there was always kind of, you know, the tax lawyers and international economists and stuff would have these incredibly complicated arguments, and they try and bamboozle you with why tax havens are great and all that kind of stuff. But on the other side of the equation, it's really simple. So many of these measures are really simple, you know, billionaires and big corporations not paying tax. And this is an economic and a political issue. And you can really engage with people from the very simplest level, and you can get as complicated as you like. But generally, you know, the tax haven operator would try and drag us onto their complicated terrain. And we always try and stick to, you know, we'd have the kind of expertise there that we needed. But we also tried to stick to the political, the kind of economic arguments, the injustice of it all. And that's so anyone can engage with these debates on tax justice or finance or corporate power. It's just a question of choosing your level that you want to engage on. So you asked about how I got into this. I mean, you know, you call me an expert, and I kind of more see myself as a sort of this kind of person who's been sort of rambling around, just stumbling across stuff and always finding interesting things. And so I'm kind of, you know, I've got a kind of eclectic set of interests that always drive me forward. But I was always, from the very beginning, I was always interested in economics. I mean, I studied mathematics and anthropology at university, which shows that I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I've stumbled around for a number of years, kind of being an English teacher as a foreign language and various other jobs. And then I suddenly one day decided I want to be a journalist. And a friend of mine who worked at the BBC encouraged me to go to Guinea-Bissau in West Africa, where it's a Portuguese-speaking country and I speak Portuguese. So I flew off there, and he gave me a tape recorder and a letter of introduction from the BBC. And the first thing I did was to go to the presidency and hand this letter of introduction to the presidency and ask for an interview with the president. And I got it, you know, within a couple of days. And so that was kind of my first thing. But always, from the very beginning, and I remember the questions I was asking were kind of economic questions. I mean, I was extremely inexperienced, but I was really always interested in kind of what made the sort of the economics tick, the money tick. And I think maybe my kind of background in mathematics might have meant I was a little bit less scared of economics than most people generally are. Most people see it as sort of bamboozling. But, you know, as I said, a lot of these topics are very simple at some level and are comprehensible at some level. It's just a question of finding the level. And so I, you know, my first trip to Guinea-Bissau, I pitched to The Economist to write an article about it. And I just wasn't, there's no way was I ready. I just needed a lot more experience as a journalist. But I was always interested in money and power and justice and injustice and kind of this connection. It's been, you know, it has proved to be a very kind of fruitful way for me to pursue my career.
It's really interesting that you studied anthropology and mathematics, because it makes an awful lot of sense given what you write and how you write about it, because a lot of what you talk about is very cultural, but at the same time, you have to obviously know those mathematical equations and the things related to economics. It kind of fills in a gap that I didn't know about before. And I guess what a lot of your work is very anthropological, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so I spent a lot of time writing about West African oil producing countries from sort of Nigeria down to Angola. And I lived in Angola and covered the civil war and then kind of moved to other places, but still covered these countries from there. And then I wrote a book, Poisoned Wells, about oil in Africa. And it was always, you know, each country was its own kind of political soap opera with a different cast of characters and different kind of stuff. But kind of oil was, it, in many ways, it was the same story. It was the same kinds of structures. I mean, they sort of manifested themselves in very, very different ways in each place. Obviously, there's a small section of an oil-rich country that gets very, very rich. But in the case of Nigeria or Angola, you get all these kind of negative effects. You have this thing called the Dutch disease, where all these inflows kind of raise the price of everything locally, these financial inflows from oil. And that basically damages anything productive relative to exports. So in Nigeria, you know, after the sort of big oil boom, they had a collapse in agricultural exports and even production as imported food came to displace local production. I remember when I was living in Angola, there was, you know, I used to go to the local markets and the chickens would be grown in Brazil and sent to Angola. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, definitely. So how did oil become the thing that you wrote about in your first book?
Oh, it's the usual story of my life is a series of coincidences. So after the Guinea-Bissau trip, I then, my friend at the BBC, because I'd also been teaching English in Barcelona, I'd learned Spanish. And he said, oh, well, if you learn Spanish, go to Equatorial Guinea. There's no journalists go there. And it's fascinating. And they just discovered oil. So I went there and I was a little bit, you know, had a little bit more experience then. I managed to get some stories on Reuters and they were happy with it. And they kind of tracked me down afterwards and said, do you want a job in, first of all, in Kinshasa? But then they did find out I spoke Portuguese and they had an opening in Angola where the civil war was going on. And so they just kind of offered me that job. And so that was an oil producing country. And that's how I got interested in oil.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And then from that, you went on to write about tax havens. And then from that, you went into writing about the finance curse, which focused more on the UK and Ireland. So how did that transition happen? Maybe you could tell us a bit about how tax havens are defined to start off with.
A tax haven is kind of a financial centre that transmits harm outwards to other jurisdictions. So the Cayman Islands, for example, you know, a bunch of Brazilian politicians will loot their economy and stash their winnings in the Cayman Islands and hide it so that they can't tax it and criminal authorities can't pursue them, whatever. And that's Cayman Islands transmitting harm to Brazil. So it's a kind of outwards like transmission of damage. And so my book Treasure Islands was all about that, about how tax havens work and the kind of, you know, the politics of it, the societal impacts of it, how it affects tax systems, how it affects inequality and all that kind of stuff. As I was writing it, though, I was becoming, there's particularly someone who in the British tax haven of Jersey, John Christensen, who had been, he'd been reading my stuff, but he was the economic advisor to the states of Jersey. And his job was to make life better for people in Jersey at the time. But he was discovering that finance was coming in and crowding out everything else. And so, you know, all the kind of tourism and agriculture was just getting squashed by finance. And it was getting squashed in several ways. One, again, was this Dutch disease phenomenon, you know, massive sort of price inflation in Jersey, particularly house prices went crazy, much more than the UK. But also this massive brain drain out of all the other sectors, including the political system, into finance. So you end up with kind of these places sort of being leached of possibilities, of talent, of good people. And he was very exercised about that. So he started talking to me about that, and it became clear to both of us very quickly that this phenomenon was also, the UK was also clearly suffering from it. Too much finance. And at the heart of the finance curse concept is this paradox. It's like more finance makes you poorer. So there's lots of research, there's lots of academic research being done on this by, like, you know, big organizations like the IMF and the Bank for International Settlements. And at the heart of the sort of analysis, there's this banana-shaped graph. And the banana-shaped graph is, it kind of measures on the x-axis at the bottom, the sort of level of financial development of a country by various metrics. And then on the right, on the y-axis pointing upwards, is like how much finance contributes to growth. And it starts sort of low. And so, you know, if your country hasn't got enough finance in it and it's got almost nothing, you can develop your economy by developing your financial sector more, by doing more useful things. I mean, providing loans for people to buy small businesses, houses or machinery or whatever, or helping them save better. So, that, you know, finance provides a lot of useful services. But then you keep growing the financial sector and eventually you get to a point, a sort of optimal point, and that's like the top of the curved banana, where finance is doing everything it needs and it needs to do for your economy. So it's providing all the services you need, and that's great. But what happens then if finance keeps growing beyond that point? Well, it gets into more predatory activities. It gets into more extractive activities. So instead of contributing to growth, it's sucking money out. You know, academics talk about this thing called financialization. So it's, you start off with an economy, you know, just like normal businesses doing normal things. I don't know, a factory making widgets or something like that. And it's doing fine and it's competing in the market and making better widgets all the time. But then you get financiers coming in and they buy up this this factory, this company. And they start applying all these kind of financial techniques to it. So let's run this company's financial affairs through tax havens to dodge the tax bill. Let's crush the workers a bit. Let's get this company to borrow a bunch more money. And then we can pay ourselves more. Us, the owners, can pay ourselves more out of the proceeds of that. Let's buy up all the companies making these widgets and build a monopoly. And then we can raise prices and so on. None of this stuff that finance, the sort of excess financialization does, is productive. It's extractive. Raising prices to consumers is extractive. Crushing workers is extractive. You know, it's taking money out of workers' pockets, out of consumers' pockets, into the owners' pockets. And the owners are probably American private equity companies or something like that. So the more finance you get in your economy past this optimal point, the more of this kind of harmful stuff you get. And then it starts bending downwards, the graph. So growth and prosperity start to bend downwards. So the more finance you have, the worse it is for your economy. The UK passed this point long, long, long ago. And it's like well over, in terms of the size of the financial sector, it's like 50 or 100% too big. And if you shrunk it, you would have a more prosperous country. But the United States as well. Wall Street has become much too big for the United States, and it's inflicting all sorts of damage. And of course, that's the economic damage. There's an enormous amount of political damage, because these sectors, you know, oil sector in Angola or Nigeria, but finance sector in the UK, United States, run tax havens, they capture the politics. So they make the politics and also the society and the culture. They capture the newspapers. Their worldview becomes kind of dominant, and it's very hard to push against it. And then, like, everything must serve the financial sector rather than serve the country. And so you have a real kind of inversion of what we want our economy to do. And instead of working for us, it works for some people out there in some kind of financial global cloud, and the money's just kind of being sucked out.
Yeah, I find it so evocative, this idea that the money is being sucked out of our economy. Like, I feel like I can almost see it when I look at the streets of England, where you just, like, the money is just being taken away and everybody's being left impoverished. And it's almost like, as you say, like, the finance sector has a monopoly over all other sectors in the UK. And it's monopolies that you're currently writing about now, aren't you? Can you tell us a bit about that transition, like how you got there and what you're writing about?
Yeah, so it's one of those strange things. Monopolies is one of those subjects that people kind of feel in their gut, but they can't quite put their finger on it. And it was a bit similar with tax havens. When I was writing about tax havens, I think people, they knew about tax havens as, like, this is an exotic sideshow to the global economy. And in Treasure Islands, I show how this was right at the heart of the whole globalization project. And it was the kind of the corruption of it. And you have to kind of lay it out, and then people get it. And I think monopolies outside of the United States, it's the same thing. People, you know, Amazon, most people think Amazon's too big and too powerful, and Jeff Bezos, we don't like him, and Google as well. There's something creepy about Google and scary, and all this taking all our data, what's it doing with it? But I think most people haven't kind of got beyond that. And they've also got this, like, well, Amazon's incredibly convenient and I can buy all my shopping on it, and Google is great because the search is so brilliant, and AI, you know, ChatGPT, all these things are, like, they're kind of convenient but a bit creepy and scary. And I think in many, many countries, people haven't really got beyond that point. And that's a very kind of disorientating place to be. And it's not the basis for building social movements and proper pushback. You do have governments trying to push back against it rather timidly, but they don't have the kind of population behind them. So I'm now writing this book, which I think will be out probably late next year, which is about monopolies and monopoly power. And we can get into what I mean by monopolies. So I'm starting, actually, the first chapter of my book's going to be, it's going to start with my cat that died. And it's going to be a chapter about vets. And so my cat died here in Berlin, and it was very sad. I took him to the hospital before he died, and they took him in overnight and charged me an absolute fortune. But as I was filling in the forms, I read the name of the company that owned the hospital, and this is a company that I've already been looking at, called IVC Evidencia. And it's basically this veterinary Pac-Man. It's just hoovering up companies, veterinary practices all over the world, particularly in the UK. About, I think, over 1,000 vet practices in the UK are owned by this one veterinary giant. And there's several others. They talk about the big six, and there's a lot of anger out there. I mean, there was a woman recently who had a dog that had some problems with its teeth, And she was so angry at the bill that she got, a few thousand pounds for nothing, that she said, oh, I'm just going to start a petition. So she started a petition on one of these platforms. And like in no time at all, she had like 130,000 signatures. There's just a lot of kind of real anger out there about, you know, people. And there's lots of stories of people going into what they call pet debt. They just can't afford to treat their animals, but they love them so much. I mean, we loved our cat and he died and we were prepared to pay lots of money to kind of keep him going as long as we could. And so that these kind of investors are really milking this love, I suppose. And this makes people incredibly angry. So what I want to do with this book is to show people there are lots of things out there that you may not think of as monopolies. You wouldn't think of a vet practice as a monopoly generally, or a care home or something like that. But I'm going to show people that there is monopolies in the way that I describe them in all of these sectors, and then show that there's an enormous amount of harm that's coming out of all of them. And we need to start thinking about how we can tackle this harm. But that's kind of the purpose of the book, is to start where people are with something real, something, you know. So there's a chapter on food, there's a chapter on beer, there's a chapter on music. These are things that people really engage with, and then sort of get into the kind of digital stuff, which is more complicated and bamboozling, but it's also very, very real. And at the end of the day, the story of Google is, I regard as potentially the most dangerous corporation of the modern age. I don't think many people would see it that way, but I hope to show how that is the case. And it is absolutely a monopolist, and it's a very, very dangerous monopolist. So I want to show the dangers, get people angry, but also show that there's plenty to hope for, plenty to fight for.
It sounds amazing. I can't wait for it to be out and to be able to read that. But I'm also very excited that we get to talk to you about it now and we get a bit of a preview of your ideas. It seems to make most sense to really focus in on monopolies. So why don't we kind of start at the beginning in terms of defining monopoly power, because you talk about monopolies in your book, The Finance Curse, and there are many different types of them, aren't there? There's many different ways that you can have monopoly power.
You know, if you look at dictionary, it's like, oh, there's one seller in a market and then they can abuse their monopoly position. And that's actually a very rare case of what happens in the real world. And there are these other, you know, there's monopoly, that's one seller. There's monopsony, which is one buyer in the market. And then there's oligopoly, which means a few buyers, a few sellers. And yeah, so these horrible, ugly words, I don't like using them, and they're the technical terms. So I just use monopoly power to describe the kind of power that comes from this kind of control. And so most people wouldn't think of Tesco supermarket as a monopoly, but I do. Tesco's got, I think, about a 25% share of the UK supermarket market share. But Tesco is incredibly powerful, and you, as a consumer, you don't really feel it, but as a producer selling to Tesco, they are screaming. They're absolutely screaming. You know, if you go into a supermarket, I'm not sure what the case is with Tesco, but I live in Germany, and it's the case in Germany. If you break a bottle, you know, smash a bottle of milk before you get to the checkout, it says, oh, don't worry about it, they won't charge you. And like, oh, that's nice of them. But, you know, how nice is it really? What happens there generally is they will force the supplier of the milk to pay for that. Not them. They won't pay for it. They'll force the supplier to pay milk to pay for it. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. They actually, because so many suppliers to supermarkets, like imagine you're a small or even medium-sized farmer and your 60% or 50% of your harvest, apple harvest, goes to Tesco, they have you over a barrel. Because if they just say, oh, we're not going to take your apple, you know, right on harvest, you've got all this apples harvested and ready, and they're like, oh, we're not going to take it, and they can do that, then there are some regulations, but they're pretty weak, then you can wipe a farmer out overnight, just like destroy their business with the flick of a switch. And so many farmers and other suppliers know that they are at the mercy of the big supermarkets, the big buyer power of the supermarkets. And they're screaming, and they know that the supermarkets know that they can tell them, do anything to them almost. So what they want to do is keep them just at kind of subsistence level if they can. And they get a sense of how much the supplier can take. And then they just take fees out of them until they've extracted all their profit. And you'll end up with a supermarket, yeah, doing very well, but the supplier's doing very badly. There was a farmer that I interviewed, Guy Singh Watson, who set up a company called Riverford Organic. He's an extraordinary character. And he was talking about how when he was supplying a supermarket for a while, and he said they asked him to come and see him to discuss, he was building some storage warehouses and like to discuss the specification stuff. And they said, can you come on Thursday? And he said to them, oh, yeah, I've got to see my girlfriend the next day. Can we do it the next day? And the phone went dead. And he's like, oh, okay. And he called back and got back through the person and said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. You know, we seem to have dropped the line. And the buyer just said, no, Sonny, when we whistle, you jump.
Ugh.
And it just really illustrates the
power. Horrible.
Yeah. And it's like that. I mean, if you talk to people, you know, they're terrified. I mean, I'm trying to get interviews with people who are supplying supermarkets is really, really hard. They are really scared. Even people who are relatives of mine who I've approached just won't talk. So anyway, so that's monopoly power. So even a company with a 25% market share, for me, can easily be a monopolist. And often, you know, you'll have a supermarket will have a local monopoly. So there'll be one Tesco in the town and no other supermarkets in a sort of smallish town. Well, that's kind of a local monopoly. So there's all this kind of concentrations of power all over the place. And the dictionary definition doesn't cut it.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's so scary what is going on with our supermarkets, because it does just feel like this kind of monolithic, horrible power, which is just so motivated by the wrong things, like not quality, not amazing service, not a good supply chain. It's just all about profit. And this thing of monopolies is one of those things where it's kind of ancient, isn't it? But actually, weirdly, in the olden days, we had better protections against it than we do now. Like from reading your book, The Finance Curse, it certainly seems like in the 20th century, at least, we've rolled back a lot of the protections that we used to have. Can you tell us a bit about the history of monopoly power and what the situation is now?
Basically, you've had concentrations of corporate power, different kinds of corporate power in the relationship with the state going back hundreds of years. So in the UK, there was a period during the reign of King James I of England, who he had this system where he got these... There were these kind of nobles and powerful people that he appointed, and he gave them kind of monopolistic licenses. There was someone called, I think he was called Guy de Montpesson, and he was given the licenses over the sort of ale houses and pubs back then, and also over the gold and silver thread merchants. And he basically brutally just ripped money out of them, really send just like people as a just mafia basically, and so they would extract huge amounts of money from the businesses, from the local businesses, and then he'd have to hand over most of the proceeds to King James. But it's totally arbitrary. They could just do what they like. There was no recourse. So somebody ran an alehouse and the thugs came, they just, what can you do? You know, we'll burn your place down if you don't give us all this money. Like, okay. But that was a kind of political monopoly thing. But it was also an economic monopoly thing as well. And so what happened then was that there was so much anger engendered by this that in the end, Parliament started fighting back, and they got a lot of support from all over the shop. And finally, they introduced this thing called the Statute of Monopolies, which made all these kind of licenses null and void. And that historians see that as a real kind of milestone in the creation of the rule of law, where Parliament was able to take the rule of law away from the king. Over the centuries, you've had huge concentrations of power building up, and then big sort of popular fightbacks, and often the popular fightbacks have won. And so the most famous era, I think, is in the United States around the kind of the era of the robber barons. So there was the Standard Oil monopoly, which controlled a large percentage of the refining in the United States. And there was the big money trusts in the United States, which kind of these interlocking directorates of kind of ownership of lots of different companies in the economy, all owned by bankers. So you had this sort of this pushback, this popular pushback in the United States against monopoly power, very successful. They broke up Standard Oil, broke up the money trusts. And
this is in the 1920s.
Yes, 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 exactly. Yeah. Like a century ago. I mean, it sort of happened over, you know, you had the Sherman Act in 1890, and then subsequent legislation after that, the Clayton Act and so on, beefing up the Sherman Act. So, and this is where the word antitrust comes from, because back then corporations weren't allowed to own other corporations across state lines. So they instead set up trusts, which are different legal arrangements that allowed them to own things across state lines. So when they broke these things up, they called it antitrust. And that kind of justification has disappeared now, more or less. It's not about trusts anymore. I mean, trusts are an issue, but that's not the key issue. But the name has stuck. But over here in Europe, we tend to call it competition policy, which sounds like a very neoliberal thing, and it has become kind of neoliberalized, the competition policy. But it's basically the same thing. When we're talking about antitrust or competition policy, we're basically talking about the same thing. After the Second World War, there was a massive recognition on the part of the United States occupying powers, but also in Europe, that monopoly power had been a central contributor to the rise of Nazism. The conditions that monopoly, you know, these massive, really horrible, crushing monopolies that were built in various sectors in Germany, created enormous anger among the kind of small businesses and so on. And also now as Hitler rose to power, you know, initially big corporations were a bit too kind of, I guess these days you call them woke, to support such a horrible bunch of thugs. But over time, they got used to him. And then they became this, you know, some of the big monopolists were supporting the Nazis from the early years, from 1933 and before. But then once Hitler came to power, they just came into their own and sort of like helping build and create the Nazi war machine. And they were fantastic agents of arbitrary power over the population, like agents of economic coercion that complemented the political coercion. And so the Nazis, you know, insisted that all small businesses organized into these cartels so that they could have this kind of centralized control. And so monopoly, key part of the Second World War, and there's plenty of research about this. And the occupying powers, when they came in, said, we've got to break all this stuff up. So they broke up broke up IG Farben, which is this huge sort of chemicals conglomerate. And also the Europeans into the sort of foundational European treaties. Anti-monopoly was at the heart of the construction of Europe. And then over time, the US and Europe evolved in the sort of golden age after the Second World War. They evolved separately, and the Europeans are a bit more favorable to nationalization rather than antitrust. But still, it was anti-monopoly was very powerful until it eventually got undone.
So how did it unravel? It was all partly to do with the neoliberal project. Is that correct? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. It's well known among economists and political theorists, the Chicago School. And there's a very well-known guy called Milton Friedman, who was an economist, who said that famously, he said his theory of shareholder value was that corporate bosses shouldn't worry about, they should stop worrying about kind of lefty things like the interests of workers or the public interest or the environment or citizens with rights. Don't worry about any of that. Only worry about shareholders, the owners of corporations. Look after them, make them happy. And then they will, if you align the incentives right, then they will turn their companies into sort of roaring engines of capitalism, and it'll create so much kind of efficiency, it'll all trickle down and to consumers and so on, and everybody will be happy. That was Milton Friedman's idea, and it became dominant.
The invisible hand.
The invisible hand, yes, yes. So anyway, so that was Milton Friedman. He's well known. But on the corporate power side, one of Friedman's colleagues was the significant person. He's much less well known, a guy called Robert Bork. Robert Bork was a piece of work. He was a right winger. He was racist. He was a real fire breathing conservative. And his argument was similar to Friedman's. His argument was aimed not at corporate bosses like Friedman was. It was aimed at regulators. And again, he said, regulators, stop worrying about namby-pamby things like, yeah, the public interest and the interests of workers and communities and citizens. Forget all that. The only thing that matters is economic efficiency and the interests of consumers. So big corporations, he said, are more efficient than small corporations. And because of all these efficiencies, it'll create so much wealth. All this wealth will trickle down to consumers. We're all consumers, so everyone will be fine. And then he said, by the way, monopolies don't really exist. And if they do, they're just fleeting, and the market will kind of sort them out. And one of the phrases he uses, as soon as there's kind of like super profits from monopoly, competitors will arrive in sky darkening swarms to get a piece of the action, and a monopoly can never survive. And he just wrote this kind of economic claptrap about how monopolies could never exist, despite all the evidence over the centuries that monopolies certainly can exist and can endure. But basically, these arguments became really powerful, and they didn't take the laws off the books. What they said, what they did instead was they said, let's override the laws with economics. So even if a company is, I don't know, pumping pollutants into a river, let's do an economic analysis to see whether the sort of the loss in terms of dead fish or people downstream is greater than the benefits in terms of extra profits to the monopolists. And if one is better than the other, then don't worry about the law, even though it's technically illegal to pump toxic waste into this river. The economists will show us that it's okay. And they use this sort of principle to override the law. So even though the sort of anti-monopoly laws, the Sherman Act and so on, were still on the books and still are today, they said, just ignore them because you need to, you know, the economists know what they know what's good for us. And so let's listen to them. So they kind of killed antitrust with economics and really bad, really, really bad economics. So the brakes came off and you just had this orgy from the 1970s, 1980s, orgy of kind of mergers and acquisitions around the globe, starting in, it was kind of like a explosion that started in the United States and it spread to Europe. You know, Europe had its kind of anti-monopoly rules, but by the time of the sort of turn of this century, 99, 2000, 2001, particularly 2004, Europe changed its rules. And so the result has been particularly an explosion of inequality in the United States, an explosion of anger in the United States, and then that explosion spreading outwards. And now we're seeing the effects all over the world. US multinationals are able to expand overseas and be monopolists and extract money and, yeah, just be extremely coercive and unpleasant. And we don't have the laws anymore to stop them properly, or at least the economics has killed the laws that we have and stopped us being able to do anything about it, anything serious about it.
Yeah, it really feels like a kind of corruption of our values, this idea that it doesn't matter how a company exists in society. It doesn't need to be there for the good of society. It just needs to be there to make as much money as possible for the shareholders. This kind of horrible profit motive, which doesn't take anything else into account. Even if you have to kind of make up loads of rules in order to let that happen.
Yeah.
And just ride like roughshod over laws that are there to make society better. And now we're in this situation where, like, you can see, and I've certainly seen it, where you have so many industries that monopolies have consolidated so that you like have, you know, a big four or a big five or a big six. It's just consolidated into these massive conglomerates. Can you speak more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. I mean, the big four, when people say the big four, they tend to mean the big accounting firms, they're big four, but in many other industries, there are a big four that dominate. I was just talking about vets, where there's a big, in the UK, there's a big six, in other countries, are different numbers. You have, but you've also had a kind of compression of these numbers. So in the past, regulators would have started getting antsy about a merger from six to five players in the market. But over time, it became like five to four is the line, and then four to three. I mean, it obviously depends on the sector. But like in, so I spent a bit of time in recently sort of campaigning to stop this merger between Vodafone and this company, this Hong Kong-based company called Three in the UK, that would, these are mobile network operators that run the infrastructure and the sort of the bandwidth. And lots of other operators out there, but they kind of piggyback off the big four because they need the infrastructure and the access to the spectrum. And then the UK government, in its wisdom, decided to allow this merger, which would have been a 4-3 merger. Now, all the academic research out there shows that 4-3 mergers are an absolute disaster. They just mean higher prices and worse quality, no improvement in innovation. It's just a sort of really bad deal. It's happened so many times around the world. And when I say high prices, I mean much higher prices. And yet, so I like tried to work with a trade union and a couple of academics to try and get the UK government to stop it. But this was just a juggernaut. And this is a 4-3 merger. It's clearly wrong. But they went ahead and they just powered it through. And so these numbers are getting smaller. And maybe one, in 5 years' time, if things don't change, we might have a 3-2 merger. And that'll be really, really bad. And that just means bonanza for the shareholders, but also much higher prices for people, particularly for poorer people who can't afford to pay twice as much for their monthly phone bills. So yes, so as this train continues, it is getting worse. There is more and more monopolization. There is more control. Just like one historical comparison. So back in the 1960s, when antitrust, this is the United States, when antitrust was really strong, there was a merger or a proposed merger between two supermarkets in California. It's called the Vons grocery case, where this would have resulted in a supermarket that would have had a market share of less than 8%. And they blocked it because they said this is too much. And they were worried about this turning into a sort of giant, you know, it would just like continue monopolizing. They said better to nip it in the bud. And they did. And that was, you know, a lot of people say that was overkill. That was crazy. But it really reflected a muscular sort of approach. And that was in an era of great prosperity and rapidly rising prosperity and political kind of, you know, obviously many political problems, but it did not damage the economy at all.
So it is possible to stop.
There's various different ways of visualizing monopoly, but think of our food systems as like an hourglass, an egg timer. So you have all the food producers at the top and the food consumers at the bottom. And in the middle is a narrow neck, and all the food has to pass through that narrow neck. But over the years, as deregulation has happened, this neck has been getting narrower. And at the neck, there's a bunch of players clustered. I mean, supermarkets are one of them, but there's also like global commodity traders. And to get your food through the neck, you have to pass through these choke points. And so this concept is like hourglass choke point is a really good way of understanding monopoly power. The narrower the neck becomes, the more power these people have, and the more inequality you'll have, and the more kind of producers will suffer and consumers will suffer, but all this sort of more and more profit will be sucked out at the neck and probably deposited offshore in tax havens tax-free. So I think that's a very useful way of thinking about tax havens, this idea of a choke point. They talk about, in regulatory terms, they talk about gatekeepers. They're like toll keepers. You can imagine sort of stuff, cargo passing on a river and a toll keeper, like, if you want to pass, you've got to pay us a fee. And that's increasingly what's going on. You know, Amazon is a great example of that. Amazon charges enormous fees to the people selling on Amazon. And if you take into account sort of logistics and so on, half the price of what you pay, what you buy on Amazon, is now fees to Amazon. And you may say, oh, well, you know, it's expensive to ship stuff. And, you know, that's just part of the cost of sending you stuff. But actually, the cost of sending a standard parcel on Amazon has doubled in the last few years. And you would think as a company gets bigger and bigger, become more efficient and costs will go down. But it's the opposite. And that's because Amazon has got this choke point power and it can just arbitrarily raise its fees. And that gets reflected in the price of everything that we buy. And so, you know, there's this idea that Amazon is the cheapest and it's delivering lower prices. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think if Amazon is charging such colossal fees on the stuff we buy, it's making a lot of stuff more expensive. And so, you know, the story that we tell ourselves that these monopolies are okay, they're convenient, they're efficient, is actually not true.
Yeah, it does seem like a real mirage, doesn't it? That we're kind of like under this weird illusion that monopolies are good, but actually they are really sucking the lifeblood out of our economy. And I really like the analogy of the hourglass. And for me, it also kind of conjures up almost like a wringing of the neck. You know, we're being squeezed and it's actually just genuinely really hurting normal people. And there's something that you mentioned in your book as well about the fact that real wages haven't actually increased. Like, we're not actually economically better off at all. We're really struggling, aren't we?
Yeah, there's a trade union called Public Service International that did a graph they called the crocodile graph. And you can imagine the sort of open jaws of a crocodile. And the top part of the jaws going steeply upwards is productivity. So that's like companies becoming more efficient and, well, companies are becoming more sort of economically productive with new technology and so on, not because of monopoly, but because of technology. And so all this kind of, so there is all this sort of stuff happening that's making companies more productive. But then workers' wages at the bottom of the crocodile's jaw just flat and they're just stagnating. And so you have this, or in some cases going backwards. And there are many reasons for this, but monopoly power is a key part of this problem. So workers feel it. It's a complicated picture of how workers feel it. On the one hand, there is, like in a small town, if there's like five vets and a monopolist buys all of them, then if you're a veterinary worker, you end up having no choice and you can be treated really badly. And if you want to get a different job, you have to go and live in a different town, which is difficult. So there's that kind of thing going on. But more importantly, monopolists are known to kind of just damage the economy. So even though there has been an increase in productivity over the years, as I said, it's really technology that's driving that. The monopoly side of it has actually been reducing kind of economic output. And that has, the estimates of how much that has damaged workers over the years are of the order of several trillion dollars a year globally. And that's a colossal amount of money. At the same time, you've got this sort of hit to workers, but you also got the hit to consumers. So workers are selling their labor, consumers are buying stuff. And so economists talk about this thing called markups, which is the difference between the costs of producing something and the price at which you sell them. So back in 1980, you know, there's one study by Yanni Coop recently, a book called The Profit Paradox, where he estimates that sort of back in 1980, the markups were what he called 1.2. And what that means is 20% above costs. So in other words, you produce a pizza, it costs your ingredients and labor cost you, you know, $10 to produce it. And then you sell it for $12. That was back in 1980. But now the markup is more like 60%. So it's gone from 20% markup to 60% markup. So you, instead of paying $12 for a pizza, you're paying $16, assuming that the ingredients cost the same, $10. So what's going on there? Well, again, this picture is complicated. You can talk about globalization as a reason, but monopoly power is an absolutely crucial part of that. Companies are able to jack up prices. I mean, it's kind of economics 101. Monopolists jack up prices. They just get power and they like, we can raise prices, so we will. And they usually do. And so this markup, this sort of $4 difference represents, you could call it like a private tax system, so that nobody voted for. It's just that these corporations are able to shift money from consumers' pockets into their pockets for no good reason other than the fact they have the power to do it. There's no productive reason. There's no sort of genuine reason why. There's no good reason why they should be able to do that. But just because they have the power, the monopoly power, in all these different ways, they can do it. And it's like they're levying private taxes on all of us and then probably not paying their taxes. You know, they're making super profit. So when they do that, they make more profit, but we pay more for our stuff. So it's like inflation and corporate profits are the flip side of each other. They're connected. So when we see corporate profits soaring and we see inflation, we feel our stuff getting more expensive. It's a part of the same phenomenon, and that phenomenon is monopoly power.
And then that profit is being taken, just sucked out of our economy, isn't it? It's not being reinvested back into our economy to circulate. It's basically just being sucked out through tax havens and things like that.
Yes, well, it's being sucked out in several ways. So a few years ago, I was in the American Midwest, Iowa and Colorado and places, and talking to farmers there. And one of the things that really struck me was how farmers were talking about what it used to be like. And they've got tours of these little towns, the beautiful little towns that, you know, I remember one particular farmer, Nick Shoot, talking to his mum and dad, who were like, his dad was in a wheelchair, but just reminiscing about old times. And while I was traveling there, I actually on a hotel television, I watched Back to the Future. I don't know if you remember that film, but
I do. Yeah, a childhood favorite.
Yeah, it's still a great film, and it kind of revolves around this sort of town square, really vibrant, like lots of kind of shops open and just diners and stuff, and just like really full of life and testosterone filled teenagers running around. But it really struck me how the contrast with the towns that I was seeing, and they're very much like dormitory towns now. People go and work somewhere else, go and work in Des Moines, in the state capital, or wherever. And they come there to live, but everything's kind of closed down. And what's happened is you've had a shift from a position where, you know, lots and lots of independent farmers, but also independent meat packers and seed processors, and the local farmer would buy their seed from the local seed salesman. They would eat at the locally owned restaurant. They would get their finance from the local bank and insurance. They would get their equipment from the local equipment supplier. And you had these kind of local circulatory systems for wealth, and wealth was going around the economy. And it was a very healthy kind of way of organizing things. And the government was, you know, this is back in sort of, I guess, pre-70s in particular, the government was very involved in managing prices, making sure that there was supply and demand in balance, and, you know, corporate power was in check, and they were making sure that no one was getting too dominated by these giant agricultural corporations. But then when the sort of merger breaks came off, and the sort of Robert Bork and the neoliberals said, just let everything get bigger because it's more efficient, all this stuff started getting bought up by the monopolists. And so what you have is these local circulatory systems for locally produced wealth. And farming is the ultimate wealth creation industry activity. I mean, you put seeds in the ground and water and it rains and up comes this fantastic food. And so all this wealth was being created locally, and it was circulating locally, and people were very comfortably off, and there was good living to be had out of farming. But then as the monopolists came in and they bought up all the sort of, you know, the food processors, so the farmers no longer had the options. They were then getting screwed by the food processors and all these different kind of aspects of the agricultural supply chain. The monopolists were coming in and picking them off one by one. Eventually farmers had very few options. And so these local circulatory systems of wealth have been unrolled and shipped out, and the wealth is now being shipped out of local communities, and it's being shipped to Chicago, to New York, to the City of London, to tax the Cayman Islands, tax havens. And so even though, again, farming technology has improved greatly and there's been improvements in productivity as a result of that, the wealth that's being created is not being felt locally. And one of the stats, there was a year, it's not like this every year, but there was a year recently when the average on-farm income in the United States was negative. So what that means is people who had farms and were doing farming were running it at a loss, and then they were working other jobs elsewhere, maybe in the state capital, to keep alive. And they were just like clinging desperately on, because I don't want to be the one in my family to lose grandma's farm, you know. And so it's a very sort of sad process. And you can see that in our high streets and in many countries around the world, where as Starbucks and Uber and all these companies come in and displaced local businesses, you get this sort of leeching of life, this leeching of humanity and vitality out of our local economies. And there are some places that are holding out okay, but other places are really devastated by this.
Yeah, it just feels so depressing. I feel like I see it so much now, where you go down a high street and so many shops are shut and boarded up and there's hardly any people around. And you know that everything has been cordoned out to these shopping centres in the suburbs, and it's just like a kind of ghost town. It feels like there's a real quality of life that we're losing, and at the same time also quality in the products that are being sold. You know, all of the quality in supermarkets is going down. Yeah. And then you have this kind of idea of what it's like for the actual people to work there. Like, as you say, the farmers having this horrendous experience where they're just like not able to make a living, and yet they have to keep going, and they're not even enjoying it anymore. And you've also talked about vets and how their experience of their job is so impaired, because they obviously went into the job because they love animals and they want to look after animals. Yeah. But now they're part of this extractive machine that they can't get out of, because there's no one else to work for. They just have to work for the monopoly that has captured them at the time.
Yeah. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of people in the veterinary sector recently, and it really, people, there's a real kind of sense among so many vets of like, I love animals and I trained for this and I always wanted to be a vet, and now something bad is happening and I'm being forced by these big companies that own my practice to charge a fortune to fix a dog's leg or whatever. And I just don't feel comfortable about it. And so and quality is really, really suffering in so many areas. I mean, today I was annoyed by sellotape. Like, why is sellotape so crap? You'd have thought after all these years they could make it easy, but you've always got to sort of like with your fingernails, you've got to kind of get it and then it sort of pulls off. Sorry, that's a really trivial example, but I think...
No, I noticed it with cling film as well. I feel like cling film is becoming rubbish as well.
Yes, all these things that could easily be fixed and they just can't, they have the power just like, oh, well, we're going to make more money if we just don't invest in it. Whereas if there had been a system where, you know, I'm a little bit hesitant about using competition. Competition is a very powerful force. It can be a very powerful force for good. It often is a very powerful force for good, but it can also be a harmful force if they're competing on the wrong stuff. But I think in the case of something like sellotape, if you had a kind of market that wasn't broken, you would probably have really great sellotape, which just worked every time and was really easy to use. Sorry, that's such a trivial example that was annoying me today. But there are much better examples. But you're quite right. It's quality. So it's not just price, but quality is absolutely, you know. And there's this Canadian guy called Cory Doctorow, who is a brilliant kind of, he's a novelist, but he's also an expert on monopolies. And he's just one of these kind of general polymaths. But he's got this concept called enshittification, which is like everything's getting worse. And there's a sort of whole monopoly playbook that is what enshittification is about. You start, and so they start with one side, you know, they start with the customers, start with the sellers and start screwing them. But then they start, you know, screwing the consumers. And there are just so many examples of that. I mean, you know, Google search, it used to be really great, but now there's a lot of kind of, leaving aside the question of AI, results. But there's a lot of kind of advertising slop at the top of your Google search now, which they didn't used to be. But that's because Google is so powerful and so dominant. They're just like, we can do this. We can just make this worse and no one's going to run away because there's no alternative. And anyone alternative that turns out, we're just going to kill it or just kind of, you know, buy it or just destroy it.
So what can we do to target monopolies and predatory corporate power?
There's something I haven't spoken about yet, and I will put it under the headline, Lena Khan. So you had this sort of neoliberalization of antitrust in the United States, and the brakes came off, and orgy of mergers and acquisitions. And then, fascinatingly, I noticed about 2016, the year 2016, nearly 10 years ago, this new anti-monopoly movement emerging in the United States. And they were fascinating. And they were basically they were real radicals. And they were seriously radicals, like, we got to break up Amazon, we got to break up Google. But what fascinated me about them was that they mixed radicalism with expertise. They really knew what they were talking about. And they said, look, there are all these laws that are still on the books. They've just been neglected. And we can do all this stuff. And we should, and we must. And here's the damage. People hadn't really seen the damage. And this small band of people became, suddenly they got massive media traction. It's like everyone woke up, oh my God, yes, it's true. Everything's monopolized. And that's why everything's so shit. And they got really good media traction. And then you got people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, but also some Republicans, like, yeah, this is true. Our economy is monopolized. And one of the interesting things about anti-monopoly is that you can appeal to people all across the political spectrum. You know, you can appeal to people on the left, whatever that means these days, but you kind of know what I mean. Like, this is about inequality, it's about corporate power, it's about injustice, it's about damage to democracy. But people on the right, you can say, look, this stuff is reducing productivity, it's harming the economy, it's corruption, it's damaging democracy. So you can appeal to people all across the political spectrum. So this movement suddenly became incredibly influential. And so in 2021, which was the year that I co-founded this small anti-monopoly organization in the UK called the Balanced Economy Project, suddenly the Biden administration appointed Lena Khan, who is one of these radical anti-monopolists. She'd been recruited to is kind of as an academic and a journalist to start writing some stuff. And she wrote some really good paper called Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, which was taking on Robert Bork and the neoliberals head on and saying, we got to break it up. Here's the problem. Here are the fault lines. This is where the conflicts of interest are inside Amazon. Look deep into the machinery, and this is where we need to cut, and this is what we need to do, and this is how we need to regulate. Brilliant piece. Anyway, the Biden administration appointed her chair of the Federal Trade Commission, which is one of the main antitrust, one of the two main antitrust regulators. And they appointed another radical anti-monopolist, or very experienced anti-monopolist, called Jonathan Kanter, to the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. And also they issued an executive order that mandated anti-monopoly across all different areas of government. It's like this huge sort of big bang of anti-monopoly. And Lena Khan was just 32 when she was appointed. She was like really young. And she started really taking the fight, and they started fighting with all the biggest corporations. And I think by the time she had left office, by the time Trump came to power, I think there'd been something like 130 attack articles in the Wall Street Journal against Lena Khan. Yeah. Just like, that's the sort of the house newspaper of big business in the United States. They absolutely hated her. But she, like, with amazing kind of dignity and restraint and calm, just like, we're going to progress, we're going to prosecute this stuff. And they blocked some serious mergers. I mean, they were heavily outgunned, but they really did an enormous amount of good. And she, I think, probably from the Biden administration, I don't know who's the most popular, but she might be now the most popular figure from that administration. And it was really thrilling to see at the time. And obviously Trump coming in has kind of washed over all that sort of stuff. But what has remained absolutely is the anti-monopoly movement in the United States. It's incredibly, people are really agitated. They have terrible healthcare monopolies, and there's been a lot of work done on that, but also all over the economy and digital, and people are really up in arms about this stuff. And so I find that a very inspirational story. There is a real groundswell. It hasn't properly reached here yet. When I say here, I'm sitting in Germany, I'm talking about Europe, I'm British, so it's also Britain. that people sort of beginning to see it, beginning to feel it, but they're not really there yet. And I think we do need a kind of people to wake up to this stuff. There are various pockets in different parts of the world. You know, the Brazilians are pretty good about this stuff, the Indians, but in South Africa, there's some interesting stuff going on. But there, we need to kind of have a wake up similar to what happened in the United States. And I think that's very doable. And I think one of the interesting things about this is that I've written quite a bit of stuff recently about the far right and the killer fault lines. The far right is riven by the absolutely unfixable fault lines right down the middle of these organizations. So you will have the supporters of Donald Trump and the AfD in Germany and Reform in the UK and all these far right parties, millions and millions of people who absolutely hate big corporations. They hate big tech. They hate globalization. They hate all this stuff that's being done to them. But at the same time, their organization and movement is funded by big tech, by big corporations, by big finance. So it's this really strange kind of, and you see it with these sort of fights between people like Steve Bannon in the United States and Elon Musk. And these fault lines are really seething. And it doesn't take much for a politician on the other side of the political spectrum to start talking about corporations and getting similar levels of support. And we've just seen that in New York with Zoran Mamdani. We've seen it in the past with Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and people like that. And so there is so much potential to tap into popular groundswells of support. A sort of anti-monopoly frame can be very, very potent and can attract, it can appeal to all sorts of people across the political spectrum. And most of the anti-monopoly arguments are basically unarguable. Monopolies raise prices, they reduce output, they have a corruption, they damage democracy, they help give rise to the Nazis, and now they're feeding kind of hatred and stuff. All these arguments you can make that are basically unarguable. And I think we just need to pick up this baton and start running with it. And that's one of the purposes of my book, which is to wake people up, to try and wake people up to these monopolies are everywhere. We may not see them, and here's how they work, and here's what we can do about them. And then here are some ideas about how we can maybe join together and do things ourselves, either individually or collectively, to try and take on this profound danger to our societies and our lives today.
Yeah, it seems a lot about being brave enough to enforce the regulations that are actually there. And as you said, like Lena Condon's done a really good job of that, to actually stop and hold people to account in ways that the legislation allows. And I know you wanted to talk also a bit about the argument that regulation stifles growth. You wanted to discuss why that's not the case, didn't you?
Yeah, so that it's like a mantra, like, oh, regulation stifles growth, we need to deregulate. And this is an argument that's been around for decades and it just doesn't work. Basically, the record shows that the era of tax cutting and deregulation, lifting financial regulations to allow banks to roam the globe more profitably, that led us to the last global financial crisis and may lead us to another one soon. And it's the same with antitrust, anti-monopoly. All this kind of like, let's let them merge, let's let them monopolize, because in the hope of attracting investment, it's allowing more and more extraction. So it's allowing monopolists to come in and raise their prices, levy these private taxes on us through higher prices and lower wages and so on, and take those super profits and take them offshore, take them somewhere else. And we're left with inflation and bad salaries. And somehow that's supposed to be good for growth. And it's just nonsense. It's ridiculous. But, you know, governments get captured, and the current so-called Labour government under Keir Starmer has been captured. They've had these big tech conferences in London with Google and Eric Schmidt, and sort of slapping each other's backs, and Starmer, we've got to go faster with deregulation because we want your good stuff. But Google is a monopolist and it's sucking so much out of our economy. But they just think deregulate, let more of this stuff happen, and somehow growth will magically appear. But it's one of those things, one of those mantras that is just so patently untrue. We need to put proper guardrails up. We need to protect ourselves. We need to protect our economies. We need to protect our small businesses. And we need to do that. The government needs to do that. And it needs to put in place good guardrails, which is another word for regulations. And we need to tax the multinationals and the rich people properly. They won't run away. You know, they always threaten to run away. But then when the chips are down, you do tax them properly, or you do regulate them properly, they realize that they don't want to live in Geneva, which is pretty boring, or the Cayman Islands, which is horrendously boring. They want to live in London, which is exciting, or they want to live in Paris or wherever. And they don't want to rip their kids out of schools. And there are all these kind of scare stories like, oh, if we regulate them too much, they'll run away and they'll take their money with them. It's the opposite. It's the other way around. We need the guardrails. We need the protections to protect our economy, and our economy can then thrive on a much more kind of democratic basis than if we just let the big boys come in and ransack the safe and run off with the sweets.
Yes, amazing. We need a more strategic and informed and long-term approach to this whole problem, and a braver one, I think, as well. Like, what you lay out is really important. And what can normal people do if they want to help the fight against monopolies?
Yeah, the first thing is to organize and connect. The way to build power, to build counterpower, is to connect with other people. And so this, and it doesn't have to be an explicitly anti-monopoly fight, but you can join an organization that you believe is doing some good. You could contribute to them. You could join them. You could join their meetings. You could go on their protests. But connecting with other people and talking about this stuff is a very important thing. It's sort of building the sinews of kind of local movements and local power. And on a local level, you know, picking an issue that matters to you and engaging politically, engaging with other people who are of similar interests. This is very important and very helpful. And I'm so suspicious of big tech firms that I would say be very careful of organizing through Facebook or these kind of big tech firms. See if you can find more creative, imaginative ways to do it. You know, you can boycott Amazon and so on. I'd encourage that and use local bookshops and so on. But the big difference is in organizing and connecting and political action.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. And I think we're lucky also to have these historical examples, like the breaking up of Rockefeller and all of the stuff that Lena Khan has been doing, just to show that we can actually get together and make change and have this monopoly power dismantled. Like, it's been done in the past, it can be done again. And yeah, it just remains to say, Nick, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your amazing insights and all of your knowledge. I really, really appreciate it. If people want to get in touch with you or find out more about you, then what can they do? How can they follow you?
I actually don't use social media. I think Twitter is toxic. X is toxic. And I'm on Blue Sky, but I don't use it really. So I have a LinkedIn page, Nicholas Shackson. You can follow that. But my book will be out next year. So hopefully that's late next year. And provisionally it's called The Big Squeeze, but that hasn't been settled yet.
Fantastic. And of course, you have your existing books as well that people can buy, which I thoroughly recommend.
And I have, yes, I mean, my books, Treasure Islands and The Finance Curse. And if you're interested in oil and politics in West Africa, it's a bit out of date, but Poisoned Wells, that's my book from then. Yeah.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been so brilliant to speak to you, Nick. And thank you so much for all of your insights and your expertise. It's been really educational, really brilliant. Thank you very much for your time.
No, great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the Social Justice Salon with me, Marianne Moore. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. This podcast is brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. Patreon subscribers get these podcasts a week early, have access to exclusive content, and can be part of my private community. If you would like to work with me, I provide social justice and business advisory services for a range of needs. To find out more, please visit my website, createtricks.london. If you enjoyed this episode, then please take the time to give it a review or recommend it to a friend to help more listeners find us. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow the podcast at Social Justice Salon and me, Marianne, at createtricks.london on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted and produced by me, Marianne Moore. I did the artwork, and the music was by the amazing Luke Fraser at The Tonic. Until next time, when I look forward to welcoming you back to the Social Justice Salon.